Welcome to Guidepost Magazine on Voice Corps. My name is Amy, filling in this week for Lisa Bischoff. For the next half hour, I'll read articles from the June-July 2026 issue of Guideposts. And they have a section called What We Love About Our Country. These individual items written by different writers. First up, from Kimberly Elkins, editor. Every Saturday morning back in the late 70s, down the hairpin curves of Wise Mountain came the two-tone bookmobile, rolling onto Main Street in our small Virginia town in the foothills of the Appalachians. There'd I be, first in line, eager for all the books I couldn't find in our middle school library. Only 10 folks in at a time, the silver-haired librarian, Mr. Varner, would call out from the top of the steps. America's first mobile library was a horse-drawn wagon in 1905, carrying 200 books to reach rural Maryland residents. By the 1960s, approximately 2,000 bookmobiles were operating across the country. Every time I stepped into the custom-fitted RV, I marveled at how many thousands of books were stacked in the floor-to-ceiling shelves. The best thing was getting the titles I'd requested from the main library. I was tired of Judy Blume novels and The Lord of the Rings. I wanted Jaws and Carrie and Alex Haley's Roots. Mr. Varner encouraged me to read as much as I could and got me the adult fiction I asked for. Every week was a race to finish the books I'd checked out by the following Saturday. Although fewer than 700 mobile libraries still serve the U.S. today, many rural communities are still gifted the magic of books by these traveling wonders. I'd wager Mr. Varner and the county bookmobile are part of the reason I grew up to become a writer myself. From Aaron Genoso of Esther, Alaska. It's amazing to me how the moments that change your life the most can arrive entirely without fanfare. For example, that time I was shoveling potato salad onto my paper plate at Esther, Alaska's annual 4th of July barbecue. I can't stay, I overheard someone say. I'm in the community band, and we have a concert this afternoon. Community band, I thought, what's that? In school, I'd love nothing more than band, but 20 years had passed since I'd last played a note on my trumpet. I hadn't been aware of opportunities where I could keep playing until now. If you want to play, we'll help you find a way, the Fairbanks Community Band's website promised. Best of all, there wasn't an entrance audition to join. It turns out there are hundreds of community bands in towns and cities across the nation. And kind of like our country itself, they bring together people of diverse ages and backgrounds. I couldn't have guessed then how much this tradition would become a part of my own life, how the people I'd meet would become my second family. We played music together, we shared lessons, meals, and our stories. These days, when I think back on that years ago, 4th of July, and all the 4ths since then, I'm reminded that whether it's the music we play or the fellowship we create with our neighbors, we are at our best when we're working together. From Greg Eanes of Owensboro, Kentucky. There's a landmark in my hometown, Owensboro, Kentucky, Wonder Whip, a 1950s-era hamburger and ice cream stand. Burgers, shakes, and cones are still served from the same building that has remained largely unchanged over the decades. You feel connected to the past at Wonder Whip, to a slower pace of life that many of us associate with growing up in Owensboro. It's a gathering place for locals from all walks of life. For generations, families, students, workers, and neighbors have met there after games, work, or church. That sense of community runs deep. Last fall, Wonder Whip stepped up to provide free meals to children when a SNAP funding pause threatened families' access to food, reinforcing its role not just as a restaurant, but as a caring and dependable part of the city's fabric. Mark Lipsinski from Gilbert, Arizona. Trains were a constant presence in Warren, Ohio, the blue-collar steel town where I grew up. My dad would take my older brother and me to watch and photograph them from as early as I can remember. Those moments ignited two passions in me, trains and photography. I pursued photojournalism, working for newspapers before eventually going out on my own as a commercial photographer. Through every stage of my journey, my love for the American Railroad endured. When I moved more than 2,000 miles away to Arizona, trains became my connection to home. I'd stand beside the tracks, the familiar rhythm of steel wheels and the scent of creosote mixed with spent diesel fuel, making the distance feel shorter. The American Railroad is unlike any other in the world, built across vast and dramatic landscapes on a scale never before attempted. The completion of the first transcontinental railroad in 1869 stitched the country together, reducing a six-month journey to about a week, an astonishing achievement before cars and airplanes existed. What I love about America is that those rails still carry more than trains. They carry history, memory, and a reminder that no matter how far we travel from home, we remain connected. And this writing has an addendum in Guidepost on the page called Family Room, Meet the People in Our Pages. Photographer Mark Lipsinski proudly describes himself as a foamer, F-O-A-M-E-R, a slang term for rail fans who get so excited when they see a train, they foam at the mouth. Mark does lifestyle, portrait, and travel photography for his clients, but trains remain the focus of his personal work. As he puts it, I document the scale, precision, and human perseverance required to run the American railroad industry. Watching and photographing trains became even more meaningful after he was diagnosed with PTSD during his late 30s. Mark had felt broken and anxious for years, but it wasn't until his diagnosis that he discovered those feelings stemmed from the trauma of having open-heart surgery at age 5. Being by the tracks, using an antique large-format camera to create long exposures of trains, taught him to be patient with himself and his healing process. You're listening to Guidepost Magazine, and I'm reading from a collection of writings submitted under the heading, What We Love About Our Country. This next one is from Chaplain Ken Sampson, Colonel, U.S. Army, retired, from Cornwall on Hudson in New York State. Harsh, aggressive, tough. This was the combat environment of Operation Enduring Freedom, Afghanistan, July 2002. During my first deployment, our Bagram headquarters was in a partially bombed-out Soviet-era aircraft hangar. My hooch, my sleeping area, was a dark, musty second-floor closet. For bedtime reading, I used a compact battery-powered fluorescent light. I'd brought along a used book purchased just before deployment, First Lady from Plains, written by Rosalind Carter. Mrs. Carter's awe-inspiring, often tender account of using power to serve people counterbalanced Bagram's grim combat setting. Aside from my family, here's what I missed most about home while I was deployed: the quiet, deep compassion, warmth, and gentleness fostered by coaches, schools, houses of worship, village fire halls, and businesses. the experience of an easygoing, though resolute, freedom, considerate and respectful of all, an awareness that when projecting the kinder face of our nation, we encourage peace for a troubled globe. There were glimpses of these values, even in that rough Afghanistan theater, dedication to high moral principles embodied by the gentle presence of an International Red Cross worker at every battle update briefing, commitment to humane treatment of detainees symbolized by the military police chaplain whose office sat some 15 feet from Bagram's holding cell, our battle-tested lead from the front commander's good humor and sensitivity to all of God's children, an expectant welcome of God's sustaining power during the variety of worship services at Enduring Freedom Chapel. This, too, is the America I love. Kirsten Anderson of New York, New York. My family's Independence Day tradition, watching the movie 1776, a Broadway show about the writing of the Declaration of Independence, 1776 was the perfect match for our love of both history and musicals. None of us saw the original 1969 Broadway production, but the first time the 1972 film version aired on TV one July, we were all hooked. We got the cast album and played it over and over so my two sisters and I could learn all the songs. We'd sing through the entire show on long car trips. Incredibly, this did not make our parents love it any less. Our mini productions got even better when I found a copy of the musical's libretto at a flea market. Now we could learn the lines, too. The script also contained notes from the show's creators, and we were thrilled to learn that Sherman Edwards, who came up with the idea for the show and composed the songs, had taught history at a high school located near us. Our tradition of watching 1776 continued after we grew up. We eventually got our parents a DVD. When our mom went into memory care, my sisters and I would sit with her and sing her favorite songs from the musical. I still have that libretto of 1776. I have to turn the pages carefully so the corners we'd folded over to mark important scenes don't break off. Next to each line of the script, you can find one of our initials, noted so that we could learn our lines for our bare-bones, three-person productions. If you want us to do it for you, don't worry, we still know it. And I'll remind you, you're listening to Guidepost Magazine, and I'm reading from a collection of writings submitted under the title, What We Love About Our Country. This next one is written by Edward Grinham, Editor Emeritus. What's more American than standing for the national anthem on baseball's opening day? Hope springs anew as the long major league season unfolds. 162 empty pages to be filled with our dreams and heartbreak. No sport is more embedded in our culture, and yet it is quintessentially an immigrant's game, a time-honored portal for new Americans to make their mark on our national character. They come from all over the world to play this game of ours. When I was a young writer in New York, an opening day ticket was beyond my reach. Still, I'd take the subway to the Bronx, buy a hot dog, and watch the fans stream into Yankee Stadium, drawing on their energy. I'd hear the strains of the national anthem, lower my dog, and stand at attention. My most indelible baseball memory came when I was a college student crewing one of the big ships hauling iron ore across the Great Lakes. My ship, the Resch, was drifting down the Detroit River on a soft summer evening. Sitting on a hatch cover, I felt a restless yearning as the Motor City skyline slipped by. I missed my team, the Detroit Tigers. Tiger Stadium stood not far from the river. The captain had cut back the engines due to the swift current. All at once, I heard the stadium crowd roar. though it sounded like a collective sigh at that distance, and a speck of white, like a tiny moon, arced above the rim of the stadium. Through the wash of lights and high into the dusk, hanging in the sapphire sky, before falling back to earth, a routine flyball. For that instant, I felt a part of something and not so alone, sitting on the deck of a freighter. So, at the start of every season, I say a prayer of thanks for the uniquely American blessing of baseball, a gift that brings us together. Roberta Messner, Huntington, West Virginia. Thinking back to the first time I heard the words flea market, I can't help but laugh. I was 14 years old in 1967 when Daddy took time off from his job on the railroad to be a vendor at a new flea market in Hillsville, Virginia. Yuck, fleas. Who would want to do that? I asked. But when he told me about the incredible treasures he'd come across and how he'd talked with folks who'd traveled from all over America to buy a piece of the past, I knew I wanted to be a part of it. A few years later, I tagged along. I was captivated by the community spirit, the nostalgia, the food. When Daddy's cancer took hold, strangers who'd become friends brought along favorite recipes in case he could manage a bite. We all cheered when PM Magazine featured him playing his fiddle in the flea market's bluegrass band. Over the years, I've explored tiny flea markets, following hand-lettered signs tacked to trees along back roads, as well as those that draw thousands to Round Top, Texas, and the Springfield Extravaganza in Ohio. The flea market that's closest to my heart is held monthly from April to October in Burlington, Kentucky. It's more than 200 vendors and loyal shoppers have become friends, caring for and praying for me through many health struggles, as people in Virginia once did for Daddy. There's nothing quite like the soul-deep connection of folks at the flea, and that's more valuable than any vintage find. The next item from Brett Leverage, editor. You never know when or where you'll encounter a hero. In 1974, as a high school junior in Oklahoma City, I took a U.S. history class taught by Clara Luper, L-U-P-E-R. She was a terrific teacher. Warm and engaging, she challenged us to think for ourselves. I knew Ms. Luper had been involved in the struggle for civil rights in Oklahoma, but it wasn't until years later that I understood the magnitude of what she had accomplished. In 1958, the year I was born, Ms. Luper and 13 of her students, all of them NAACP Youth Council members, conducted a sit-in at the lunch counter of Katz Drugstore in downtown Oklahoma City, an establishment where black customers were not served. The peaceful sit-in, one of the first of its kind in the United States, continued for 3 days and resulted in the Katz drug chain changing its policies and integrating lunch counters in its 38 stores. On November 1st of 2025, Oklahoma City dedicated a memorial plaza on the former site of that downtown drugstore. In the plaza sits a bronze sculpture with life-size depictions of the lunch counter, Ms. Luper, the student activists, and a Katz employee. There's one empty stool at the counter. On my next visit home to Oklahoma City, I will make my way downtown and take a seat on that stool as my way of honoring Ms. Luper and her 13 heroic students. From Jenny Ivy of Cookeville, Tennessee. My grandparents had no musical training. Truth be told, they didn't have strong singing voices. What they did have, back in the late 1950s and early 1960s, was a beat-up Chevy sedan with no radio. Whenever Grandmother and Granddaddy and I drove anywhere, be it to the Safeway around the corner or clear across Arkansas to visit kinfolk, We entertained ourselves by singing. We'd warm up with children's folk songs. Then the gospel singing took over. Gospel music is exactly what you'd think, songs that convey the message of Jesus in a catchier, more accessible way than formal church hymns, dating back centuries to the time when enslaved people in America sang spirituals as they labored. Gospel music began reaching a wide audience with the advent of the radio in the 1920s. My family's favorite Southern gospel singers were the Carter family, Johnny Cash, Hank Williams, and, of course, Elvis Presley. I still know the words to many gospel songs by heart. Will the circle be unbroken? I'll fly away. Swing low, sweet chariot. I saw the light. Peace in the valley. I sometimes turn off my car radio and, with the windows down, sing those songs with gusto. And yeah, from somewhere beyond, I hear my beloved grandparents joining in. From Rick Hamlin, New York, New York. We live in Upper Manhattan, overlooking the Hudson River, and my morning jog takes me through Margaret Corbin Circle. She was one of the first female veterans in American history, a heroic fighter in the Revolutionary War. The neighborhood is called Washington Heights for good reason. Our apartment sits on the site of Washington's fort, the hilltop from which the Continental Army tried to defend the island of Manhattan. It was a tough battle. Overrun by British troops, Washington had retreated across the river to New Jersey, leaving the fight to a brave group of soldiers. John Corbin was one of them. An artilleryman, he was joined by his wife, Margaret. She was used to accompanying his regiment, cooking, doing laundry, and caring for sick and wounded soldiers. On November 16, 1776, she stood at her husband's side and helped him load his cannon. When he was hit by enemy fire and killed, she didn't hesitate. She stepped behind the cannon and continued firing it. She, too, was wounded, but survived. On July 6, 1779, the Continental Congress awarded Margaret Corbin a military pension for her service, the first woman so honored. As we celebrate 250 years of independence, I can step out of my apartment and spot an old cannon in the park, just like hers. From Julie Lavender, Statesboro, Georgia. In the 20 years that my husband David served in the Navy, we often had to be apart on the 4th of July, like many military spouses. But I never had to look far to feel part of a community. Fort Stewart, Hunter Army Airfield in southeast Georgia, about an hour's drive from our house, goes all out to make the holiday one to remember for active duty military and their families and for civilians alike. Thousands of people from all walks of life show up. Gathered on the parade field, we are one. Proud to serve our country or support someone who does. Rows of crepe myrtles line warriors' walk, each tree a living tribute to a brave soldier of the 3rd Infantry Division who made the ultimate sacrifice defending the freedom we're here to celebrate. Children play with streamers and nibble on hot dogs. Moms and dads talk of deployments, tanks, folks back home. There are games, contests, food trucks, live music, and for the grand finale, fireworks that light up the night sky to oohs and ahs. Fort Stewart is extra special to David and me because, after retiring from the Navy, he worked here as a civilian wildlife biologist. It feels like our second home. And this year, as we celebrate America's 250th birthday, there's no place we'd rather be. And finally, this one from Chanel Eliason of LeClaire, Iowa. What says down-home America like the county fair? One of my earliest childhood memories is of walking through the bunny barn with Mom, 4-H ribbons decorating the wire cages. Years later, when I had my own children, Preparing for the fair contest consumed a whole month of summer. My boys built displays for their hobby show entries, framed their photographs, and once brought home a grand prize trophy for a camera made of cardboard. After the boys' projects were settled, I found time to bake and usually swept that division with passed-down recipes for cookies and cakes. Once the ribbons were awarded, my husband, Lonnie, and I would buy ride passes for all five of our sons, seating the younger ones on the carousel lions and tigers, and watching the older boys spin and slam in their bumper cars. Afterward, we would share sticky caramel apples and bright cones of cotton candy in the shade. The fair was community. It was a bridge of generations. If I live to be 100, I'll still remember the dizzying joy of the tilt-a-whirl, the enticing calls of the barkers, the teddy bears won in a good game of darts, and the dust beneath our feet as we walked the beaten path of the Midway at the county fair. And those writings, again, submitted under the banner of what we love about our country, in the June-July issue of Guidepost Magazine. And that's all for this edition of Guidepost Magazine. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for more programming on VoiceCorps, your audio access to the world.